Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
670 The Score is the official radio home of Cubs baseball.
Stallings heading to the plate. Schwarber throws all the way to the plate. They got a play. He's going to be out at the plate. What a throw by Schwarber.
Live from the Hyundai Studios, this is 670 The Score. WSER and HD Chicago. WBMX HD2 Chicago. A radio.com sports station. The Score! Molly and Hall.
We're trying to wake Chicago up.
Live at 5 on 670 The Score.
And here they come.
You look at Luis Robert. My goodness, I think it just is jaw-dropping. He saw 10 pitches on Saturday night, and he ended up with 9 total bases. Right. He had a home run, 2 doubles and a single, scored 2 runs, and you don't get the sense that it was like a one-off either. You feel like he could do that almost every time out or once a series because of just how explosive he is at the plate.
I think it's really fascinating to think about the future with the White Sox, because he and Aloy were together on the Zoom call, and Aloy was just cracking up. You could see the friendship of it was like watching like a comedy routine, the way they were going back and forth, and a lot of it was just Aloy and just him cracking up, and I loved it. And I thought to myself, like, God, this is unbelievable. We're going to get to watch all these guys develop together. At some point, Nick Madrigal looks like a leadoff hitter, and then you had Luis Robert. It's just incredible to see those guys and how good they are, and to think about them being together.
Mike Mulligan and David Hall.
Your morning guy over there.
Mornings on The Score.
We have a texter who checks in, and I think this is how we ought to play this. Again, Mike Trout with speed for Luis Robert. That's the comparison. Our texter says Robert is Aaron Judge with power. We ought to keep that going. We got to Paul Bunyan this thing and just turn him into a mythological superhero.
I don't know how much more mythological you get with Aaron Judge and Mike Trout. Who else could we compare him to? Willie Mays, Ken Griffey Jr. Is there a Barry Bonds in there somewhere?
Barry Bonds without the juice.
Molly Hall.
I'm so fired up.
Here we go.
Molly and Hall, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Woo!
It is an early one this morning because it was a late one last night, Mr. David. How are you, sir?
Morning, Molly. Happy Tuesday. Yes, it was. Earlier this morning, the Blackhawks lost to the Oilers.
I think the Sox game just ended, too. I don't know.
Yeah, but at least that one you can celebrate after. This one, the post-game show for the Blackhawks, that was a, I don't want to say predictable because I thought the Hawks might actually steal a second game in that series, but you knew that Connor McDavid was going to do something special in this series, and he did that last night. And they can give their hats back to the people who threw them onto the ice. Thank you very much. But Connor McDavid was on fire, and boy, is he fast. Boy, is he special.
Yeah, I thought it was it was the kind of game, you know, you watch McDavid under huge pressure. We talked about it yesterday. There was even you know, there were a lot of people trying to defend him because one of the charges after the first loss was that the guy was personality deficient. I think a writer out in Colorado said that. And, you know, I don't know what you want. You want a guy to knock some heads and scream and shout. And there are just some guys that have, you know, even-tempered personalities. A lot of great players have had even-keeled personalities. And So you felt he was under pressure, and my God, did he take the pressure off in a hurry. That first goal was a minute in. The second goal, you're just kind of like, okay, so this guy is really that guy, right? I mean,
he scores on his first shift 19 seconds into the game, and he scores on his third shift. And then to what you're saying, I thought it was funny. After the first period, they do the in-between period interviews, and, you know, because of the feed, because of the bubble, we have to take what they get. And he was the player that they interviewed, and I thought the same thing when we heard him kind of – he did not want to be there, and he was giving us the answers, like, very hockey-like, very business-like, but boy, is he – does he do his talking with his stick and on the ice? And he was just too difficult for the Hawks to stop last night.
Yeah, it was a game for neutrals or fans of Edmonton. It was not a game for Blackhawks fans, although they were in that game, and they were in that game late, and then they weren't in that game, and it was another kind of, you know, sudden ending to it. But I thought it was admirable the way they fought back and the way they were kind of still kind of hanging around. And I thought as the game was going on, you know, this thing's not over. I mean, as much as a team strikes as quickly as they did, and you're right, it was first shift of the game, boom, McDavid. I think that the second shift of the second period, they scored another goal. So you just kind of, you know, it just was – when it got to 3-1, you're like, oh, boy. And then they came – roaring back and fought their way back, and that's fun to watch, but it takes a lot out of a team, and really the slow start ends up really kind of biting you by the end of it.
And you thought and you sensed, we talked to Eddie O yesterday, and you knew that the Oilers were going to come out with probably a higher degree of urgency, because they knew that in the previous 55 best of five series in NHL history, only one team had overcome an 0-2 deficit. So they played understanding that. And so the Hawks, if they could absorb and withstand the first 10 minutes, you felt like they had a shot. But it was pretty difficult to overcome. I felt like, you're right, when it was 4-3 in the third, you thought the Hawks were just one kind of fluky goal away from you know, taking this who knows where. But they got a little sloppy. Maybe they got a little tired, and there were two goals in 40 seconds in the third. Corey Crawford, that was not his finest hour. And I think he went behind the net, kind of misplayed a puck, and then you felt like the air was out of the balloon for the Hawks, and then there was another goal, and it was 6-3, and it was over.
Right, and they had the goalie change to start the game with Mikko Koskinen in net, and not surprisingly, I found myself yelling at one point, "Ricochet one in off his arse." I'm screaming because
that's a lot.
I saw that happen with Mike Smith.
That's a mouthful, though. you're yelling that at the television.
I was trying to stay awake. I was trying to stay engaged. It was a way of keeping myself fired up.
Read the hockey glossary to stay awake. You know, the thing that I felt like last night as well was, you're right, there are opportunities there, but what we saw in the first game with the Hawks' power play being so good and I felt like so effective, they were 0-4 last night.
Right.
And they had back-to-back opportunities in
that
the second period.
Yes.
You know, it's 3-2, and you've got a shot to kind of really make a difference here. And both times, the Oilers, they blocked so many shots.
Yes.
I mean, it was like Mutombo out there. And the Hawks could not get anything through that. And that was a key point to me in that game in terms of momentum.
I thought it was interesting because on the broadcast, Eddie O talked about this idea of maybe using your time out there. Because they had been on the ice for a long time, and even with the man advantage, you know, you're getting exhausted. And then they talked about how much he likes the second unit. But I really think that was a key turning point in the game. I was, as I watched that, David, and I thought, you know, when they got the second penalty, you've got this amount of time now to get yourself a goal, and you kind of have to come out of there with one. And I thought it was a real lift to Edmonton that they managed to kill that penalty, both of those back-to-back. I thought that was a big moment of the game.
And Joe Quenneville used to talk about this a lot. Sometimes when you get a power play and you're unable to convert, it can be deflating as well to a team. And I felt like that took kind of the wind out of the sails for the Blackhawks, because you're right, they didn't call the timeout. They went with the younger the kiddie core, or however they refer to the second power play unit. And, you know, it wasn't together and it wasn't effective. And even though you saw last night Doc had a couple assists and DeBrincat had a couple assists, I felt like the younger Hawks did not raise their level of intensity to match the Oilers. And that was a problem because the Oilers understood the urgency better than a lot of the Hawks did on the ice. And whether it was Nylander, you know, turning over the puck with a bad one, or Boqvist getting beaten time and again, you saw young players not able to elevate their level of play, and the Oilers took advantage.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It was a lost opportunity, let's put it that way. But, you know, they still won the first game, and they still are a team that is dangerous. And, you know, you got the response you thought you'd get from Edmonton. Maybe ultimately you didn't get the response to that response, right? I mean, that's right. What playoff sports are all about. There's going to be shifts and changes within, and that's not a hockey reference, but there are going to be kind of the undulation of a playoff series in any sport, and you've got to be able to respond to it, right? And that's the one thing that you kind of came up short with, unfortunately.
And now the series shifts back to wait a second. Doesn't go anywhere, does it?
And that just stays in Edmonton. And everybody, apparently they've got a lot of fans there because people threw their hats on the ice.
Yeah, enough of that. Yeah. The home ice advantage kind of, you knew, they're not throwing their hats if they're in Chicago.
Right.
You know, that was definitely, but give McDavid his due because guy is fun to watch.
Well, I mean. Again, if you're a neutral, maybe, but if you're a Hawks fan, you're like, don't.
No, I know. No. He's a nemesis right now, but you can appreciate just how explosive he can be. And pretty much, you know, I was thinking we rave about Luis Robert and how fast he is. And I felt like I was watching the Sox and Robert had just stolen a base. And I went back to the Hawks and I saw McDavid with the puck. And I thought, how are these guys so fast? They're both extraordinary with their speed.
Loved what happened with the White Sox. They came back and they did not enjoy seeing Carlos Rodon go down. And we had talked about this before the idea. I hate to say this, but, you know, I know he had a shoulder issue. His velocity dropped like a stone, and he had to leave after two innings. And I hate to say this, but I felt there was an inevitability about that. And I was kind of dreading this because we had talked about it before.
Yeah.
You know, they effectively had four guys coming back from Tommy John surgery that were going to be guys they could now rely on the bullpen. Oh, Michael Kopech's not going to do it. Okay, well, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Oh, no, Jimmy Lambert is going down. And by the way, they put him on the 45-day injured list yesterday. They shifted him from injured list to greater injured list, so you're not going to have him. Rodon then gets hurt, and I'm sitting there like, okay, you can't bring up Dane Dunning. Do not turn to Dane Dunning. It's got to be Ross Detweiler, right? I mean, don't you have to try something other than, and maybe you have to scrape it together with the bullpen at this point, but I don't think I want Dane Dunning being brought up here after seeing two of the Tommy John guys go out, and reportedly one of the reasons that Kopech opted out was, you know, obviously personal issues, but also this idea that, you know, you're ramping up without enough time, and I think we've seen that now a couple of times.
It's been almost a fluky series of injuries or setbacks, and you don't want to push Dunning unless he's ready, and I guess you would err on the side of caution given what you've been through. Last night, I had held out hope that Carlos Rodon was fixed and was going to be okay, but when you see his velocity dip to the extent that it did, and you know afterward, I guess he had felt a pain in his neck and then extended to his shoulder, and you just don't know because it sounds kind of mysterious and chronic, and you wonder what is the next step for a guy coming off the surgery and trying to get back on the mound, and it's just unfortunate because he offers the Sox a lot, but they did come back, and Mankata was great at the plate, and it's a different guy every night, and that's a sign of a good offensive baseball team.
Yeah, and they brought up Mazzara, so that's kind of interesting. So now we're going to be seeing him. Yermin Mercedes went back down. He had one at-bat in his career. I mean, a 27-year-old rookie, another guy making his first appearance in the major leagues. He got one at-bat, and unfortunately, he's back to Schomburg with the rest of the guys. That's got to be really deflating for him. But, you know, the Sox inching ever closer to getting their lineup together, the anticipated lineup, may well all be together at some point here, crossing fingers and toes and eyes and everything else.
It's great. I mean, it's fun to go back and forth last night between the Hawks, the Sox, and the Cubs. The
yes.
Sox have their fifth in a row. The Cubs win their fourth in a row. I mean, this is Baseball City USA this week, and, you know, the Cubs did it with familiar style and in a familiar source on the mound, starting pitching. Alec Mills was really good, and then they have Rowan Witt come in, and they aren't scoring as many runs as the White Sox, but they're getting it done a different way, and both teams are playing at a really high level right now, and that's fun to see.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, the thing about the Cubs is – that's not a good team that was coming into town, but you got to win those games. We talked about this before. You've got to beat teams that you're better than, period, end of story. And I thought it was a very kind of solid, not spectacular, but they did exactly what you have to do in that situation.
And they got good news with Jose Quintana throwing 30 pitches
yeah.
during a bullpen session. And then you look at like, okay, where does he fit, by the way? Do you miss him? That has been how good the Cubs rotation
right.
has been, in that they have been able to kind of withstand the loss of Quintana. You always will have room for a veteran left-hander, a guy with his experience. But right now, the last four times, the last four Cubs starters have given up one earned run combined since Friday. And I think that tells you just how good their starting pitching has been.
And we'll get into all of it. We got a lot to talk about. We got playoff hockey, we've got winning baseball. There is a lot to cover. We even have some Bears news. So we'll get into everything, and we'll start that process with the 5 at 5. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station.
It's 5 at 5 with Mully and Hall, where we debate the top 5 sports stories of the day and then open it up to you, the Chicago sports fan. Call us at 312-644-6767, or you can tweet your thoughts at Mully Hall. 5 at 5 with Mully and Hall starts now.
What was the biggest difference in the Blackhawks game? Where do you think the series is headed now? And can Connor McDavid be stopped?
Moves and counter moves. I think that when you look at the biggest difference, it was the aforementioned Connor McDavid. I mean, the guy was under a ton of pressure. He needed to perform, and he came out and he had his game. So that will be remembered as the Connor McDavid game, because of the hat trick and the fact that he scored a minute into the game and he gave his team a two-goal advantage to start, and the Blackhawks never led in the course of that game. So, I think the takeaway is that they got a really good young player, and you got to be able to respond to that. And, you know, they probably heard all about how difficult things were for them 5-on-5. And, you know, again, you cannot give up any penalties, and boy, their kill was really good. I mean, I think they're number one in the league in penalty play, and they're number two in penalty kill. That's pretty good. So you just want to diminish special teams as much as you can. But listen, they were under pressure. McDavid came out and was just fantastic, and you just say, okay, take that one away, and you chalk it up. But you gotta answer yourself now. So we'll see what the Blackhawks, what their answer is.
I think you saw on last night the difference between a desperate hockey team and a team that felt really good about what it did in Game 1. The Oilers were the desperate hockey team, and you can tell these things, I think, in hockey as much as in any sport, and the urgency and the reality that if they fell behind 0-2, they were not going to win this series. And you cannot give them an inch, because they'll take a mile. And you saw that. It just takes the slightest crease for Connor McDavid to break through. And he had those grade-A chances, as they say, in the first period. And he took advantage. You know, he scored on his first two shifts of the game. He was ready. They were ready. They were more prepared for that moment than the Blackhawks, who I think that afterward, Jeremy Colliton, give him credit for acknowledging this. And I will remember this about his postgame. We can't have any passengers. And when he says that, he was referring to guys who did not raise their level of play or their intensity, and they were overmatched. Guys like Dylan Strome, who was a -4. I don't like plus minus, but when you're -4 in 12 minutes, that stands out. Adam Boqvist, who's just, he's going to be a very good defenseman, a very consistent guy, but he wasn't last night. Nylander with a sloppy turnover. Guys like that who aren't as experienced as your core four, as your guys that you can count on, who need to be that good every night. They weren't ready for the moment. The Oilers were, and there was then at sequence in the second period, Mully, the back-to-back power plays where the Hawks were unable to take advantage. The game wasn't as much of a blowout as the score implies, but that just illustrates how explosive this Oilers team can be in small spurts. And when they score two goals in 40 seconds in the third period and they open up with the way they did with McDavid, that's a lesson to be learned. Let's hope the Hawks get it by Wednesday night.
Yeah, not a lot of time to learn the lesson. A lot of urgency and intensity in these short series here. And we all knew going into this thing that the Hawks were going to be big underdogs, and that Connor McDavid is one of the best players in the league, and that any fast attack is going to make the Hawks defense look like Swiss cheese. And that's kind of what happened last night. I think in Game 1, you know, long layoff, I think, I don't want to call that a coin flip game, because, you know, the Hawks have a lot more playoff experience than this bunch. I think the Oilers have only made the playoffs, once or twice in the past decade. So maybe, Game 1 was the Hawks kind of leaning back on their experience and kind of taking advantage of a younger Edmonton team. But at the end of the day, the talent is going to win out. And you see all of that talent on the Oilers, including McDavid, who is, you know, you compared him to Louis Robert there, just in terms of speed, I know, earlier, David. He is a lightning bolt. I mean, he is unbelievable. And it's going to take a huge performance from Corey Crawford, even though the defense didn't really give him a chance, but he's going to need all the help he can get. And you're going to need a big game from, you know, Patrick Kane or somebody of that ilk in the future, somebody to step up for the Hawks like Kubalik did in game one to kind of drag them over. Because if you're just comparing rosters here, Edmonton has the better one. That's very clear, not even just from last night, but look at where they both were in the standings. And there's a reason that the Oilers were favored, like I said. So it's going to be tough to contain Connor McDavid, and you think that Edmonton has their mojo and their confidence back, and what they did last night in their minds are probably thinking, well, this is who we are, and we found ourselves again. Let's keep going.
Well, Connor McDavid, that was the biggest difference. I mean, look, the Blackhawks just weren't able to rise to the occasion in this one. Where is this thing headed, though? If you look at game one, I don't think that was a one-off. Well, we asked yesterday, is this series going to go the distance or will it be a short one? I still believe this is going to go the distance. I still think the defense can rise to the occasion. I still think Corey Crawford is going to emerge and do the Corey Crawford-like things that we know he can do to stop goals from coming in net. So I anticipate this thing will go the distance, and we're going to see the Blackhawks actually, you know, come back for the next game.
Yeah, after last night, I think it's definitely a five-game series. It's the bad part, the thing that makes you worry as a Blackhawk fan, is that the Oilers bounce back from basically a knockout blow. I was texting with a buddy of mine in Canada that said the Oilers were getting all kinds of crap for the way they came out and played. Now, the Blackhawks have to find somebody to kind of, David knows more of this than I do, what the right word is, but put a hat on McDavid, assuming somebody can catch him. I also think this could light a fire under a guy like Kane, who's ultra competitive and one of the best to ever put skates on, and, you know, might see himself a younger Kaner in a McDavid, so he might be a little extra motivated. I think this is going to go back and forth. Mully pointed out in the first segment, you know, point, counterpoint, move, my move, your turn, my turn. Crawford made a mistake. He made the same mistake that the Oilers goalie made in game one that opened up the door for the Blackhawks after they were down 1-0. This is far from over, and it's going to be really exciting, despite the fact that we have to stay up until the following morning if we want to see it all.
Well, Molly, you're asking me questions, and I have no idea. How's it going to work out? I don't know.
The Cubs and White Sox have won 12 of their last 13 games combined, making Chicago Baseball City, USA, the past 10 days or so. With both teams at their best, how would you rank these units? The Sox offense, the Cubs starting pitching staff, the Sox bullpen, or the Cubs offense?
That's a tough one, because I think that when you watch the Sox bat, it's like one thing after another. If you're trying to get anything done or kind of have the game on as background, you just can't get anything done when the Sox are at the plate, because you're like, oh, I'll go after this bat. Oh, wait, I want to see Mancata. Oh, wait, I want to see Abreu. Oh, geez, I have to see Grandal. Oh, my gosh, how many batters till Madrigal? Oh, and then Louis Robert again. So it's just one thing after another. It's fun to watch the Sox bat, and I think they're explosive. So that's what I thought my answer would be. And then I look at the Cubs, I'm like, oh, my goodness. Their starting pitching is not only good, they're historically good right now. And I saw the stat from Stats, I believe it was, through 10 games this season, Cubs starting pitchers have held their opponents to a 156 batting average, the lowest by any team starting pitchers through 10 games since 1920 of the live ball era. I mean, that's crazy good, and I think that's unexpected. I don't know if it's as sustainable as the White Sox offense is, but I will give them a slight edge, so I will go Cubs starting pitching, Sox offense, Sox bullpen, and then the Cubs offense, which has been very good as well. They'll hit the home run, but they've been grinding out at bats, as they say. I don't know if they're doing it more often with David Ross than they did with Joe Maddon, but they are making an impact. So I would go with that order of four.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and I think it's a really difficult one to kind of go through. I'm going to say that the Sox bullpen is the number one unit, only by comparison with the Cubs. I think that when I look at the two teams, you know, the Cubs starting pitching is unbelievable. The Sox bullpen has been unbelievable. So I'm going to go with the Sox bullpen. followed by the Cubs starting pitching, and which is ridiculous because both these teams are like offensive juggernauts. So it is a really difficult thing to try to work your way through. But I think that the Cubs starting pitching is better than the White Sox starting pitching, but it's not as much better as the Sox bullpen than the Cubs bullpen. Does that make any sense? I just think that is the best unit if we add all of them together. So the Cubs are still figuring out their bullpen. The Sox a little bit farther ahead. So I'm going to say that's the strength of the team. But it's their offense is unbelievable. You know, winding up winning that game yesterday when you had every reason to lose it, that was just fantastic from a Sox perspective. So, I think this is fun to sort of look at. But I'm not quite sure how to rate these units, to be honest with you. But I'm probably going to give the Sox bullpen, then the Cubs starting pitching, then the offenses are a wash to me right now.
I think up to this point, you'd have to say that the Cubs starting rotation has been the best unit overall, despite the White Sox being first in baseball in batting average, fourth in runs scored. Could be a lot higher in that second category if there weren't still so many bloody runners left on base. And Mully, you were kind of complaining about that yesterday, and I was here in the studio nodding along with you because it's very frustrating along the course of these games when you see so many missed opportunities. But they have been able to, especially recently on this five-game winning streak now, be able to come through late, which has been very nice. But back to the Cubs rotation, so far it's been the best, I think, absolutely. When you look at what Tyler Chatwood has done in the first couple of games, he's been one of the best pitchers in all of baseball. Alec Mills has been very good. He's not a guy that we expected a lot from. I think it's safe to say coming into this season, a lot of us were kind of curious at the decision to include him in that rotation, and he's performed very adequately, more than adequately, so far this year. John Lester has nothing left stuff-wise, but he's got so much intestinal fortitude, we'll say, because it's 5:35 in the morning, but he's a very, very... you know, he's full of guile and grit and all of these other things, and he's just kind of getting by on that. And Darvish, we all know about the stuff there as well. Hendricks is as reliable as anybody. So thus far, it's been the Cubs staff. But I think if we're talking about sustainability throughout the course of the rest of the season, I would be more willing to back the Sox offense to do what they've been doing for the rest of the year as opposed to backing the Cubs starting rotation going forward to perform the way they have for the first couple of seasons, because I don't know how much longer John Lester can get through the course of this year on just guts and grit and guile. And I don't know if Alec Mills, as well as he's been performing, I don't know if he's going to be able to give you a dozen starts the way that he has looked so far this year. I don't know if Tyler Chatwood has finally become who they thought they were signing, or if this is a flash in the pan. I think that with his history and his inconsistencies over his Cubs tenure, I think it's fair to raise the question of whether he's going to be able to keep it up for the next 10 or 12 starts. And the Sox bullpen's been really good too, but again, they've been grinded down to a nub already, and with, you know, players dropping like flies on that White Sox pitching staff, they're going to continue to be worked and potentially overworked. So I don't know about the sustainability of that either. So long story short, I will say Sox offense is the best unit here, because I think I would back them to carry on what they've been doing for the rest of the year.
I like that thinking, Kevin. I'm just going to simply rank this based on what we've seen so far, not necessarily sustainability. So your rankings may hold up better than mine, but I hope the Cubs starting pitching holds up, because I'm going to say that that's been, to this point, the best unit. And really... pleasantly surprised, and hope guys like John Lester, Alec Mills can keep this thing up here, and you, Darvish, as well, because Kyle Hendricks is going to be very dependable all season long. So the Cubs starting pitching has been a very, very good, pleasant surprise. Right behind them, number two, is the Sox bullpen. You know, again, Kevin, you raise the sustainability issue, but they have really kept the White Sox, you know, in games. They have not been able to depend on their starting rotation, so this bullpen has been great for the White Sox. And then the offenses, the Sox offense will be third, because they've been really mashing the ball, and the Cubs offense has not really lets you down very much so far to this point in the season, and you just hope it doesn't go broken.
Yeah, I think overall, long term, it's the Sox offense. I'm with David where you can't turn the television off. You can't walk out of the room when the Sox are up to bat. I got people I live with, the Peanut Gallery. We've watched more White Sox baseball in the last 2 weeks than we've watched in a year. And I said, well, that's because they're good again. That's because this is what I do. I need to watch. And I'm changing from the Marquee Network over to NBC Sports Chicago to watch the Sox bat. It's must-see television. The Cubs starting pitching would be second. Cubs offense has been okay. It seems like they're not going to get five runs every night. They could be really good. It just seems like sometimes when Chris Bryant's in the lineup, I feel like they stand around and watch Chris Bryant. Like they just, oh boy, is he tall? Like I did when I met him in the clubhouse that one time that Millie likes to reference all the time. My neck still hurts from that encounter. And then, of course, my guy, Ross Detweiler. You know, White Sox fans, you guys are going to have to get on board because Ross Detweiler could be a major, major player in the future of the Sox this season. He's going to be very, very, very important.
They're in trouble if they got to rely on Ross Detweiler. I'll tell you that much.
Your question is very intuitive.
Carlos Rodon left Monday night's game after two innings and 26 pitches, 22 of which were strikes. How disconcerting is that for the White Sox? How predictable, given the number of injuries to pitchers in Major League Baseball? And does the fact that Jimmy Lambert was moved to the 45-day IL raise worry for anyone coming off Tommy John in a shortened season?
Oh, I think so. You know, I mean, I got to tell you, I like the idea that it's predictable that someone would get hurt. Given the number of injuries to pitchers, it's also predictable that Carlos Rodon would get hurt because he's been injured for a long time now, a lot of his career, and it's a pity because I don't know that we're ever going to see the best of him, and I think he's a really good dude, and you know I feel bad for him, but that when you see a guy's velocity dip like that, that's alarming. And, shoulder stiffness, the starts in the neck, it just sounds awful. It just doesn't sound like the sort of thing that that you're going to really just bounce back from. So I think it's worrisome, and I think that we're moving on here a little bit, right? It's a pity because you really thought that this could work for the White Sox, the idea that their starting pitch, they were going to have whatever it was, 9 or 10 starters to choose from, and now they're struggling to find five. So, not a good thing. I would be very careful with Dane Dunning, frankly, right now, and I am definitely concerned about the starting pitching of the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, I liked it a lot better when we were debating the pitching depth and wondering whether Rodon or Kopech was going to be the guy at the fifth starter spot and who was going to be healthy enough to have 12 starts this year. That's not the case because Kopech opts out, Lopez gets hurt, Rodon goes down, and Jimmy Lambert is a guy that was promising, and now he's on the injured list. You do think that the Sox should be cautious because of all those things with Dane Dunning, and you have to – you know, I would think look at it from the short-term perspective more than the long-term in terms of just trying to make do with what you have. And we can, you know, poke fun at Ross Detweiler and we can, you know, point out the obvious deficiencies in his career and what he offers you. But guys like him and Gio Gonzalez, and they're just going to have to get by, I think, because maybe Lopez comes back, maybe he doesn't. You don't want to push anybody before they're ready. Just look around baseball outside of Chicago. I mean, Soroka goes down last night for the Braves with an injury. Otani has an injury with the Angels that's really going to keep him off the mound. There have been other injuries to pitchers that you wonder if it's because of the irregularity of spring training 2.0 or summer camp. You wonder about some of these things, but you don't want to be contributing to that if you're the White Sox, so you want to err on the side of caution. You can still hope to outslug people because you have such a dynamic offense, and you're obviously worried about the next decision you make is going to put somebody in a position where they might be rushing back to the mound. So be cautious, be smart, and you just feel bad for some of these young pitchers who aren't able to realize their potential because of these injuries.
Well, you know, first of all, when it comes to Carlos Rodon, you know, I hate to be snide about it, but didn't we all kind of think this was going to happen? I don't want to call it an inevitability or anything like that, but Mully, you brought up the point. He's not been healthy, like, ever. What, do you have one season where I think he made over 25 starts since he was drafted here 6, 7, or 100 years ago, whatever it feels like? He's not been reliable. And I think expecting anything from him coming into this year, you know, coming off Tommy John and the shoulder surgery he had 2 years ago and all of the other times he's been shut down or put under the knife, I mean, you just can't expect a guy at age 27, 28 with all that wear and tear on his arm to come back and be effective for you, even in a 60-game season. I mean, I wasn't buying into that narrative that Carlos Rodon is healthy and he's motivated and he's got a point to prove. It's just, that's fairy tale stuff. You know, this is the real world, and guys just don't come back from all those injuries on their arm, particularly the shoulder, because I think that's what the issue is here. You can fix an elbow, you cannot fix a shoulder. And ever since the shoulder surgery, he just has not been a guy you can count on. And even before then, he's not been a guy you can count on. So, you know, he's done in Chicago. I don't think we're going to see him again this year. And his contract, I believe, is up. And he's going to move on and try to catch on somewhere else. Good luck to him. I don't know how realistic that is, though. The injuries are piling up fast and furiously for the White Sox and all around baseball. David, as you noted there, in regards to Dane Dunning, he would seem like the next logical choice to come up and get a spot in the rotation. But I do think you have to be very patient with him. You have to be very, very slow going with the ramp up and building his arm strength up, because there have been a lot of injuries and he is coming off Tommy John surgery. I don't think that you rush him. Maybe you give Detweiler a spot start here within the next week or so. I don't think he's a long-term sustainable option for the year. We all saw what he did last year. It was kind of similar, where he got off to a pretty decent start and then everybody figured him out and they were like, okay, it's Ross Detweiler, let's start teeing off. So I think that's a very, very short-term option. That's not something that I would look for in the rotation. I think it will be Dunning or maybe, you know, we talked about who's going to be trading, who's going to be wanting to give up assets this year. Maybe you take a flyer on a guy with a big contract that a team is not wanting to pay, and you take on a big salary. You take a flyer on a guy. They've still got a decent amount of depth in their minor league system, and failing that, you know, there's always the classic player to be named later. So you might see a little bit of movement here. You might see a transaction with the Sox, because this is very disconcerting, and as good as the bullpen has been, you know, like I said earlier, I don't know about the sustainability of that either when your starters are either getting hurt early in games or only going 4 or 5 innings.
It's very disconcerting that Carlos Rodon left the game injured yesterday, because in just a couple of weeks, the conversation went from, wow, look at this deep starting rotation for the White Sox, to now, wow, Ronaldo Lopez on the IL. Carlos Rodon out injured now with some shoulder problems, and he's had a history of shoulder problems. So, it sucks, but also it is predictable due to the nature of the bizarre spring that we saw that ramped up and stopped for a long period of time. And then there was spring training 2.0, which was truncated. So it was very predictable. We knew we were going to see injuries. It just is unfortunate that we see two of the arms in what was once the deep White Sox starting rotation get hurt here. And it's going to be interesting to see how they handle it, because they have to address that fifth spot there in the rotation. So, yeah, very, very, very disconcerting for the White Sox all around when it comes to pitching.
Just get my guy Ross Detweiler in that rotation ASAP. I am with Kevin, though. I think it would make sense in the long term, assuming the Sox are continuing winning 5 in a row and maybe 7 in a row and 8 in a row and 10 in a row, that they go out and trade for a guy that's worth a lot of money to another team that's not in it. You don't want to be trading any current assets at the major league level, so we have to go into the minor leagues, but that seems like the right approach. But for right now, get Ross Detweiler in that starting rotation.
That's a pretty easy question to answer.
Did Rowan Wick claim the Cubs' closer role with Monday's four-out save against the Royals? Did Alec Mills solidify his spot in the starting rotation with seven shutout innings? And are the Cubs really this good?
They could be. They could be if the bullpen performs like it did last night at the back end with Rowan Wick stepping forward a day after Jeremy Jeffress really had a good outing. This is a bullpen by committee, a closer by committee approach that David Ross kind of talked about before the game when he said it's going to be a full team effort down there. I don't think he's committed to any one guy anymore because he can't be. And that's refreshing because you worry that he would be. You worry that he would. Maybe it wasn't a large group. Maybe people thought he would always approach it based on merit. I wondered if it was going to be, you know, faith in his buddy Craig Kimbrell that wasn't rewarded. And we have reasons to see already why he should be really cautious and Kimbrell should be just another guy down there. Yeah, I did shudder a little bit when I found out that we all heard Rossi say that he was going to Kimbrell next on Sunday. If they would have gone into a 12th inning, but they won it and they didn't have to face that reality, because you're going to see him again, Craig Kimbrell, but at least it's not in a situation that you think will be high leverage. Maybe at one point he gets it, and maybe at one point he will be part of the committee, but I like that approach. As for Alec Mills, he's the guy probably going to be the odd man out when Quintana comes back. You give Quintana an opportunity to prove himself, but you know what Mills can do now. You have a lot of confidence, and we just had a discussion about the White Sox pitching depth and how quickly that can evaporate. So if you're the Cubs, you don't have to worry about a problem until it exists. You don't have one yet, but you're ready if you have an injury or if you have a setback or if you're, you know, whatever, you want to give a guy an extra day, you can do that. There might be some doubleheaders, and Millsy gives you an option. So all things considered, the Cubs' bullpen improving. They've tried 14 guys down there. I like the committee approach. The starting rotation is going to carry them this year.
Yeah, you know, there's a little smoke and mirror element to it, quite frankly. Look, the bullpen came in and kind of solidified the sweep of the Pirates in that series finale, and that was really good to see. And then you come back and you manage to beat Kansas City. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the opponent is the whole story here, but it's part of the story. So Rowan Wick, I mean, it's nice to see the guy do okay for himself and have a save. That's great. Is he long-term that guy? I would say no. I don't know who that guy is. I think that, Jeffers, was he the guy? I mean, I think you're right. I think it is bullpen kind of by committee, closer by committee. That always scares you a little bit. I don't know what the long-term plan or what the solution is to figure out Craig Kimbrell, but he's not going anywhere. There's a lot of money invested in him, so you're not going to just sort of move on. You're going to try to do something. As far as Millsy is concerned, I thought he was great yesterday, but I think that when Q comes back, if indeed that happens sooner rather than later, and who knows, but I think that Mills will be the guy that moves into the bullpen and might do a lot of good there. I'd still be worried about the Cubs' bullpen, and I don't know that I would be, doing as many handstands over the victories over Pittsburgh and Kansas City. I think it's great. I think it's important. I think you got to do it. But I also think that the quality of the opponent has to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, but you do have to beat the teams that are on the schedule ahead of you. You have to beat the teams that don't have as much talent as you do, and the Cubs have done exactly that. They did also take 2 out of 3 from Milwaukee in the opening series. We have to look back and consider that. They played pretty well against the Reds, and now they're beating up on the lower opposition. Of course, the schedule will turn up a little bit here after this. They've got St. Louis, maybe. We'll see what happens with that. Milwaukee after that, and Cleveland as well, and then they got the Sox coming up. So the schedule will get a little bit tougher. We'll have to see how it goes, but 8-2 is 8-2. I don't expect them to be 16-4, so I don't know if they're this good, but I think they're better than I thought. I didn't think the starting rotation would be this good, and a couple of guys in the bullpen have surprised me, particularly Jeffress, who I thought was completely washed when he was cut by the Brewers last year. He's been pretty good so far. You know, Casey Sadler, Winkler, these guys are not exactly household names, but they've been performing. So you can't fault the Cubs for anything that you've seen from them so far. You know, you can look about this, you can look at the schedule, you can talk about, you know, guys getting off to inordinately hot starts, you know, sustainability, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, they are 8-2, so you do have to give them credit.
Well, we know that Rowan Wick has not solidified the closer role. As you know, as you guys pointed out, this is a closer by committee, as David Ross said after the game yesterday. But I mean, if he keeps going out there and looking as good as he does and becomes dependable, he could be a potential future closer. And Mully, closer by committee, yes, scary. It does not put me at ease as a Cubs fan. Kind of makes me feel uneasy to think of the fact that the guy that you were supposed to be able to depend on as the closer, you can't depend on, and that it's going to be a different guy out there, because we haven't seen this bullpen be all that reliable so far this season. In terms of Alec Mills, he's looking great. I think he did solidify his role in the rotation. This is just going to be, as Kevin keeps pointing out, a sustainability issue. In this rotation, you have Kyle Hendricks and maybe Yu Darvish you can depend on. Chatwood, Lester, and Mills, I hope they can keep it up, but Alec Mills is looking like a hell of a pitcher right now.
I mean, you want to talk about a fairy tale. A closer pitched 1 1/3 inning in Major League Baseball? How did that happen? I didn't know that was allowed for a closer. I thought they could only come in the 9th inning with a clean situation. Wow. Listen, it's one game at a time. It's one start at a time. It's one situation at a time. Just keep you know, reticulating down the field. You know, that's what the old Kansas City Chiefs Monday Night Football radio analyst used to say, reticulate down the field. Just keep doing that, Cubs. Just keep going around the bases. Go out there one game at a time. Do your thing. And let's see. Maybe next time you could get 1 2/3 innings, and then we'd really have a fairy tale to talk about.
Yeah, wear out your one good reliever. That's a good idea.
What kind of question is that?
What do you think of the NFL setting a Thursday at 3 p.m. Chicago time deadline for players to opt out of the season due to COVID-19? Is that fair, or do players need more time, and do they have enough information at this point?
You know, I don't think it's fair. I think that you should be allowed to get more information. I don't understand why the league doesn't want players to have more information. I think this is a response in part to the idea that there are, what, over 40 players that have already opted out, and you would wonder to be curious to see how big that list grows. There is also 70 players plus that have been on that COVID-19 list that they have, which means not necessarily that they have it, but that they've come in contact with someone. So it's disturbing. You know, look, they haven't even really started practicing, right? There's certainly been no hitting. I would imagine that you will need more information before you can make an informed decision. So I kind of hate the deadline. I understand why we got to get up and running. Everybody's got, you're in, you're out, all that stuff. But I do think that you look at what's going on in baseball. We thought they might stop this week. Who knows? Maybe they will. You know, we don't know what's going to go on with the NFL. We don't know if there's going to be a spike of cases. And you figure there probably will. So I think it's an early kind of decision they want, basically because so many people have opted out.
I think you're right when you hear Jordan Lucas from the Bears become the second player to opt out. That's a headline you kind of expect to see in every NFL city. This is a decision that's a difficult one, but you expect it. And they should be given as much time as they need to make it. And that's why I think this is a bad move by the NFL. I think it's in response to maybe some players or agents using that as a threat to negotiate or renegotiate their contracts. I think it's also in response to the worst of the situations where it's carried out to the extreme. Some players might be opting out, and they were in fear of maybe getting cut. So they're taking the $350,000, and I think they're trying to avoid those kind of realities. But to me, those are the exceptions, and the rule is – that there's fear and anxiety in every player's mind. If there's not, there should be. And I understand why there would be. So give the players as much time as they need. This just smacks of greed, and I just don't like it.
No, of course, it's nothing but pure greed. That's the way that not only the NFL, but most businesses operate and have been operating over the past several months. We've barely made any progress whatsoever since March as a country. And it's pathetic, quite frankly. And it's really sad because every other country, you look at every other country in the world, pretty much in the developed world, and they've got a decent enough handle. And here we are looking like fools. So that being said, you know, things are still changing every day. There are still more cases. This is by no means over. Setting a deadline for players to opt out when everything is still in so much of a state of flux is just, it's terrible. And just not surprising at all, though, from the NFL. This is who they are.
Setting this deadline is not fair to the players. They should have the right to change their mind based on the virus, based on what's going on around them at any time.
I agree. I don't understand the greed aspect of the answers at all. How is this greedy by the NFL? We don't have time, but maybe later. I mean, you know, the old saying, you know, do your business or get off the pot. I mean, let's just go. You know what's, this didn't just pop up. This has been going on since March, and it's been in your head that you could have made a decision. So make a decision, stick with it, and move along.
Quick answer is it puts a team in a position of strength when negotiating and renegotiating a contract. So it gives them the favorable position. That's greedy.
It's Mully and Haw, the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.